Wisconsin has its pleasures. Take muskies in July. Winter's nice with all that ice and snow at Christmas time. Beer and brats are tasty, but quite apart from these, there is only one thing that we love, and that is cheese. Hey, I'm a living cheesehead that you are talking to, and cheeseheads stick together like, darling, I'm with you. So if you really love me, and when you end up, please, honey, I come from Wisconsin. Give me sex or give me cheese.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Tampa, Florida, is John Nichols, who is The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent. He's also the associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. And he and Robert McChesney co-authored It's the Media, Stupid, and Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. He also wrote The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney and Dick, the Man Who is President, Dick Cheney. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Nichols.
It's terrific to be with you, Ian.
So tonight, I guess Condoleezza Rice is going to speak about foreign policy. And then, of course, the big event, the keynote, is coming from your fellow Wisconsinite, Representative Paul Ryan, the VP nominee. You've got Reince Priebus from Wisconsin, who's a good buddy of his, as the head of the RNC. And you also, last night, Governor Scott Walker addressed the convention. What's happening to Wisconsin?
Very good question, my friend. I think the best way to put it, or the best way to explain it, is that Wisconsin is a real battleground state. It's one of the toughest battleground states in the country. And as a result, Republicans and Democrats, but particularly Republicans in recent years, have had to get really good at politics. They've had to learn how to spin the message, but also how to spend an immense amount of money and to do it in a way that wins elections. And so the simple reality of what's happened in Wisconsin is that the Republican Party has honed a lot of its messaging, a lot of its approaches over the last couple years. And now that's coming to fruition. It's coming not just on the state stage, but on the national stage. And you're seeing it in play. Wisconsin's not the only state where this is happening. There's a handful of other states, Ohio. If you took a look through an Ohio prism, you'd see Governor John Kasich as a major player, both within the party at the state and national level, but also Rob Portman, Kasich's senator, who could well have been picked for vice president. If he had been, you'd see we'd all be talking about an Ohio overlay. But the bottom line is, these battleground states, these places where politics is not easy, politics is hard and it requires, you know, a certain savvy approach. These places are becoming, kind of your breeding ground, if you will, for some of your edgier politics.
So do you think it's going to be in play? Obviously, the choice of Ryan, at least the Republicans feel that it puts Wisconsin in play. And the Republicans haven't won Wisconsin since Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, no, it definitely has some impact, although I think you have to read it carefully and understand that that impact is not wholly definitional. Paul Ryan represented a small portion of Wisconsin, one-eighth of the state's congressional district. He was not a statewide political figure, not a particularly prominent player, and he is now, being represented to the state as a national figure. So that's actually a little complicated because there are a lot of Wisconsinites, Democrats, independents, who aren't particularly happy with Mitt Romney or the Republican platform, and they won't necessarily flip over immediately to voting for Paul Ryan. The fascinating thing is that though Ryan is now on the ticket and should be having all this impact, it looks like his presence has only been worth 1 or 2 points in the polls, has not redefined the race. And the only thing that that's done is make Wisconsin competitive. It is, in some sense, a problem for Barack Obama and Joe Biden, in that they now have another state they're going to have to work on. Had Ryan not been put on the ticket, Wisconsin would have been in the Obama column without much concern. And it may actually end up there, once Election Day rolls around.
Again, I'm speaking with John Nichols, who's in Tampa, Florida. He is Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent. And one of the reasons I think that Ryan was chosen is that he has managed to get reelected in spite of his incredibly conservative politics, in a largely blue-collar working-class district in Janesville, Wisconsin, right next door to where Russ Feingold grew up. So it's all very hard for me to understand how those two politicians could cohabit, but maybe that's the history of Wisconsin, with Senator McCarthy on one side and Robert La Follette on the other. But
that's exactly right. Yeah, you nailed it. That Wisconsin tends to produce major players on the right and the left, but not many major players in the middle. And so it is not at all uncommon to have a Wisconsin official who is, kind of a leading figure on the right and one who is a leading figure on the left. To give you an example of it, slightly lower level politics, but when the control of the House of Representatives shifted back and forth in the early 2000s, Republicans controlling then to the Democrats, then ultimately back to the Republicans. A couple of Wisconsinites, David Obey, was in charge of appropriations, the most powerful committee from a financial standpoint. James Sensenbrenner, who represents a district, an hour away from Obey's, was the very right-wing chairman of the Judiciary Committee during the Clinton impeachment, and then of the Science Committee during some of its real backward actions as regards global warming. So you start to see that it is a very distinctive state that produces a very distinctive politics, and that is in play on a regular basis. And it's one of the reasons why you mentioned that Wisconsin hasn't voted for a Republican for president since Ronald Reagan. You're right about that. But in many of those elections from 1988 to 2004, 2008, the Democrat only won by 8,000-10,000 votes. It was very, very close results. And so, what you really end up with is a situation where, despite the fact that the Democrats have what looks like a winning record on paper, the reality is that it's usually a very competitive state.
Well, it's obvious that the Republicans have an extremely arbitrary and casual relationship with the truth. And their campaign, all of their ads are just flagrant lies. And it's pretty hard to believe that Ryan, with a straight face, is running to save Medicare when the Ryan budget will eviscerate Medicare. So I'm just wondering, though, whether the fact that he seems to be able, at least in his district, appeal to the blue-collar Reagan Democrats. Do you expect that to be the thrust of his speech tonight, and I'm just a regular guy? Because the last speech I saw him give in Janesville, he was referring to some of his buddies that had been out of work. This is a guy.
No, you got it. Yeah, that's exactly right. That he's going to try and fancy himself a kind of a relatively blue-collar, Irish Catholic, Reagan Democrat kind of guy. The only problem with that is it's a complete scorching lie. He's never been blue-collar. His family is multi-generational, very wealthy, millionaires. To give you an example, his family has been rich longer than Mitt Romney's family has been rich. And Paul Ryan has been a Republican insider all of his life, his way up paved by family, friends, and political allies at every turn. And in fact, it's funny, I was with his mom an hour ago at a fundraising event. I've known the Ryan family for many, many years. And, this is a wealthy, kind of an elite family that fit into a certain mold. They weren't jerks about it. They were of the community. They gave back to the community, but they lived in the house on the top of the hill. And when Paul Ryan went to Congress, he did not go to Congress as some sort of paleo-conservative budget balancer. That's not who Paul Ryan is. Paul Ryan is a Chamber of Commerce Republican of the old school who believes in using the power of government to restructure rules, regulations, laws to favor business and to favor wealthy people. That's what he has always done. It's what he will do as a politician. He got away with it in Wisconsin in part because of a fantasy. This notion that his district is a blue-collar district, that's true. But it also has on its northern tier all the Milwaukee suburbs. And so the blue-collar union workers were invariably outvoted by the suburban workers. And when you start to understand it in that way, you realize that this is not, you know, this is not a guy who was winning, you know, over union members necessarily. He might have gotten some of them in an off year when there wasn't a very strong Democratic candidate. But by and large, he was winning with the classic Republican suburban and small town votes. And I'm not sure that he will translate well into a state like Ohio or Pennsylvania, where you have a lot of blue collar workers. Certainly that is the hope. That is the dream of the Republican machine at this point. They desperately want that to work. But I, you know, you and I talk a lot about media, Ian, and you've done such good work on it in so many ways over the years. And I think you understand that this is really going to be a test for media. If a minimally accurate portrayal of Paul Ryan and his policies is revealed to the American people, he will lose. I mean, he will actually bring the ticket down. He will be damaging to the Republican ticket. On the other hand, if he can get the media to buy into a pure fantasy of him as, you know, some kind of working class kid, then, you know, that's a much more problematic situation. And one that, you know, again, it won't be Paul Ryan winning. It will be the media making it possible for a candidate who, you know, is in no way in tune with union members and blue-collar workers to fool them again.
So, John Nichols, since you're down there in Tampa, just give us a flavor of what you've seen so far. we've had, you know, of course, last night you had Ann Romney humanizing her husband, and for all of the reviews have been pretty glowing about her speech. And then, of course, you had Chris Christie. The humorist Andy Borowitz has an article out in his Faux News articles saying a deranged man slipped through security at the Republican National Convention and managed to make a keynote speech. I mean, he did seem like he might explode at any moment. And
it was a ridiculous. It was one of the most uniquely dysfunctional keynote addresses in the modern history of politics. It played reasonably well with a certain group of people in the Republican Party, but no one in their right mind could have tuned into that and said, oh yeah, I'm really comfortable with this. You know, I want this as my option. And it was especially absurd because he appeared right after Ann Romney. So Ann Romney gets up there and talks about love, about, you know, the power of love and things like that. And then, you know, here you have, you know, Governor of New Jersey get up and say, well, it can't be about love. It's got to be about respect. Forget about love. You know, that's loser stuff. That's bad stuff. Well, come on. With all due respect, this country has never, ever wanted leaders to tell it tough stuff. America has never said, yeah, give us every, you know, bit of tough information. We just deal with what we have to deal with. No, America is a land of hope, right? And the one thing that united Ronald Reagan's candidacy in 1980 and Barack Obama's in 2008 is that they both had as their default term hope. You know, they both offered a notion that things are going to get better under them. To have somebody like Chris Christie get up there and tell them, no, it's, you know, it's going to be pretty awful, and, you know, you're not going to love us, but you'll respect us for, you know, cutting your arm off. Mm-mm. No, probably one of the worst messages you could possibly deliver from a pure political standpoint.
Well, but it was also somewhat deranged, but not necessarily, that doesn't mean it wouldn't be appreciated by Republicans, because a lot of them are living in a very comfortable delusion about what the party stands for, in the sense that he was saying that we will bring free enterprise and market solutions. Meanwhile, the other side, the Obama people, they just want to coddle you. Now, the notion that the United States government coddles American citizens is so absurd, given what little social services exist in this country, and that those that do, Medicare and Social Security, are both under attack by the Republicans who want to eviscerate them. The only people that the U.S. government coddles are the military-industrial complex corporations, agribusiness corporations, etc. It is just an absurd notion. But yet, obviously, you have to assume that that kind of ridiculous stuff resonates.
Yeah, but, you know, I got to tell you, I'm not even sure how well it resonates with the Republican Party. I agree with you. It resonates with a certain portion, you know, a tiny portion of talk radio listeners. If you can imagine this, if it's possible, overly intellectualized right-wing budget hawks. Maybe that plays well with, because they've bought into a fantasy and think of it as some sort of deep, you know, well-thought theory about how we're going to save the country by, you know, essentially gutting out government at every level. And to them, maybe this makes sense. But that is a tiny portion, even of the Republican electorate. You know, you think of the Ron Paul backers, and Ron Paul backers who really had a hard time at the convention the other day, very badly treated by the leadership of the party, so much so that Ron Paul is not going to support Romney for president. And yet, the Ron Paul backers, you know, they're very anti-government. I mean, really down on it. But if you go to a rally, what they talk about is getting rid of government and creating actually a very attractive circumstance. Now, you and I might really disagree. We might argue with them at every point and say, this is just ridiculous. It's not going to turn out that way. But they don't deal in, you know, horrible austerity and deep cuts. They say, well, you get government off your back and everything's going to be great. Christie actually got up there and basically said, it's going to be bad. It's going to be ugly. That is not, it's not going to get you elected. And that is why the bottom line is that the mood in Tampa is one of, everybody wants to talk about Ann Romney's speech. He's a Republican. Nobody wants to talk about Chris Christie's speech.
Hmm. So
they may agree with it, some of them, but they get it. It was a bad, bad message.
But isn't that the central message, though? Isn't that why they have that debt clock featuring it so prominently? The idea that this is all about deficits and somehow this irresponsible government has run up the debt. And if you, using the family checkbook analogy, you can't live beyond your means. It's all very simplistic stuff, but presumably that's what they're trying to sell.
Absolutely it is. There's no doubt of that. But it doesn't mean that they're stupid enough to think it's actually appealing. You know, what they're going to do, here's what they want. They want to have a feel-good argument for austerity. And you and I know, especially from dealing with the European experience, that austerity is brutal. It is a horrible, horrible and fully dysfunctional approach to creating a civil society. And it is invariably used to redistribute the wealth from poor and working class people upward to the very, very rich, even in a difficult economic time. And so, you know, I mean, the arguments against austerity are so strong, so, you know, logical that they're a very hard sell. And yet, that's what they're going to try and do. They know they can't sell it realistically to say, well, you know, we just bailed out the banks. We bailed out a lot of, you know, big industries. Now we are, you know, paying for wars that we put on credit cards and all that. And so you need to suffer because we did all this stuff for the military industrial complex and Wall Street. And, you know, the American people would logically say that's crazy. And, you know, we want rich people to pay a little more in taxes. Polling shows overwhelmingly that is the favored position. We want corporations to pull their load, and if they don't, we want to regulate them and hold them to account. That's what the American people want. So the Republicans have to sell a fantasy that we are in a crisis so severe that we can't do that because those guys might leave or those guys might do something else. And so you, the citizens, have to take all the burden. It's a ridiculous, dysfunctional fantasy. And the only way you could possibly sell it is to make people feel like it's a happy, positive thing. And that's what Paul Ryan's job is tonight. And can I tell you, Ian, it's a hard task. I do not envy what Paul Ryan has to try and communicate. He may pull it off. I don't know. Ronald Reagan pulled off some incredible fantasies. But I'm going to tell you, convincing the American people that it is in their interest to pay off the unbelievable debts run up on behalf of the military-industrial complex in Wall Street, I mean, that's a tough sell.
Well, John Nichols, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Tampa, Florida.
It's great to be with you, Ian, and I must say I do a lot of interviews. It's always good to be on with you and get into some of the deeper issues.
Well, thanks again, John.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with John Nichols, who is in Tampa, Florida. He's the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent, and he's also the associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. And he and Robert McChesney co-authored It's the Media, Stupid and Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections and Destroys Democracy. He also wrote The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney and Dick, the Man Who Is President, Dick Cheney. Again, I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Michelle Manos. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.